opening words are going to be given by Julie Patton, who is our speaker today. She teaches at the University of West Florida and is a longtime friend of the Unitarian Church.
Good morning. The opening words this morning are from the Quiro Apache Nation. Looking behind, I am filled with gratitude. Looking forward, I am filled with vision. Looking upwards, I am filled with strength. Looking within, I discover peace. For those of you who don't know me, I have a longtime interest in mind-body practice and multicultural spirituality. In fact, I have a certificate that I gained over 2 years by going to Boulder to study with Joan Borisenko. This has really kind of been the passion of my life, and it informs most things that I do, and it informs my thinking about the topic that I was asked to speak on today. Paula asked me if I could talk about peace, and I said, yeah, what I would talk about was inner peace. Because as many of you who know me know, I had a very difficult year last year that has ended with a tremendous regrouping. And I just wanted to share with you some of the dimensions of the difficulty and then how I've regrouped. I entitled the talk, Peace in the Time of Cholera, because basically I think we've been through and are going through a very choleric period, where there are many different and competing ideas about how we should go forward. Some people think maybe we should go backward. And there's a great deal of tension I found with many activities that I was participating in regard to what people wanted and how they were conducting the discussion. At first, I attributed the problems to Trump. And what I've come to see is that Trump is a symbol of a much larger problem, an issue that we have in this country right now. It has helped me some to define, in a sense, what I think is causing a lot of our difficulty. It's also helped me ignore Trump and his antics. Basically, I don't pay much attention to what he's doing on a daily basis, unless I can get a laugh out of it. Most of my news at this point comes from Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and Samantha Bee and the people who really look at the unfolding pageant that we have going on all the time and have commentary on it rather than taking it enormously seriously and diving into it. My own feeling about what the problem is, the basic dilemma we have, is that it has something to do with the size of our institutions and with the global nature of the world that we inhabit. And my own feeling is that our social structures are no longer adequate to the problems that we're facing. Our social structures are modern structures, but we're living in a postmodern world. And basically, the modern social structures were not made to solve the kinds of dilemmas that we're having in a postmodern world, and they're not very efficient or effective at doing so. What it does, I think, is create tremendous cognitive tension and a lot of social stress. For those of you who are not terribly familiar with the term postmodern, what it involves is the idea that the world that we inhabit is a world that we've constructed. We've obviously constructed it in the world. This building that we're standing in today, the lovely garden that you have out there, the driveway, are really not things that have been here from the beginning. They're human creations. And in the same way, our consciousness is constructed and made. And so we're born into it. We're born into some cultural understanding of what the world is like. But the problem is that each group attributes truth to the cultural situation into which they were born. So that right now, for example, you have a group of modern day Christians who really believe that their interpretation of the world is the only interpretation, that their holy book is the only book that has truth to it. And what postmodernism does is go beyond that and say, well, actually, yes, there is truth there, but there are many truths. Each culture, each group creates an assumptive world in their head and in the natural world, basically. And all of them have some truth. None of them has the whole truth. But we need to recognize that multiplicity of truths that's out there. And that is what's called postmodernism. Part of the reason that people who teach in universities at this point are so vilified, in a sense, by lots of people in the society. I open the opinion page every day and am very concerned to see what's written about university professors today. But part of the reason that we're so vilified is that we are teaching from the perspective of postmodernism. And we have to do that because we have students from all lands and all cultures. They inhabit the classroom together, and we have to meet all of their needs in some way. But there is a large group of people in this country and also in other countries, we're not unique in this, who really feel that their truth is the truth and who are unable or unwilling to make the transition to postmodernism. So what we're living with is radically different truths and many people within the world feeling that their truth is the only truth. What this means is that a great deal of our action is ineffective, even or especially when we're following the rules, because the rules at this point don't really result in what they used to result in, which is some kind of reasonable action that meets the problems that we have. And often I think about things like traffic rules. You know, when you're thinking about traffic rules, you don't think about Pensacola Boulevard, which has been under construction and full of orange cones for 5 years, six, 7 years. I don't know. Seems like a long time. Creighton Road, which is one of my routes. Businesses go out of business because we never can actually get the roads fixed. The whole issue with the new bridge is really very daunting if you're trying to get anywhere near downtown from any place else because the routes are constantly changing there. I bought a transponder to go to the beach because, as I'm going to say, that's one of my remedies. But I can't figure out on the website how to put the $20 on so that I can use the transponder. And so basically, I'm still going through the cash line and paying for it. And at the university, we're dealing with so many different computer systems that don't work with each other. It's hard to call anybody on the telephone. If you want to call a doctor or call about your MasterCard bill or whatever it is, you need to set aside a morning to do that because calling people on the phone really is not working well anymore. So a lot of our action is ineffective and difficult, and we need some kind of disruptive and radical change, but I'm not really clear what that is at this point. And so I guess I found in the spring that I was really exhausted and overwhelmed by all the differences, the disagreements, by the different truths, by the multiplicity of ways in which people are marginalized in this postmodern world. And what many of you know is that I've been doing a race and reconciliation group. I've been kind of facilitating that for 3 years in the community. that also had become burdensome because I'm not really good at getting other people to do things. So I was pretty much doing it all myself. So I guess I found myself in a situation that started with enormous effort, had enormous effort all the way through, and my effort was conducted in the usual ways. My assumption was that I would do what I said that I would do, that it was necessary to have civic consciousness and go on and so forth. And it wasn't that those assumptions really were not paying off for me. And I was really sick, literally. There's a woman on the internet whose name is Nadia Boltz Weber. She's the tattooed priest. What she talks about is that no matter how well you're juggling or what it is you're juggling, there's a point at which you're going to begin to drop the plates. And she says, just do it. Just drop the plates. Drop the effing plates is what she says. And so at a certain point in the spring, I just did. I stopped all of the things that I was involved in, and I've spent the summer trying to heal. And so I wanted to talk about the process of healing and some of the ways of thinking about the dilemma that we're in right now. I remembered an article that I read in the New Yorker probably 15 or 20 years ago. This was an article about a Bruegel exhibit that was in New York. And the person being interviewed was an art critic from the UK. What he said is, I don't really understand Americans. I don't understand you at all. Because you take things so seriously and you get so feverish about everything that happens. He said, my own understanding of the story of Jesus in the middle of the storm when he went to sleep in the boat is that when a storm is raging around you, you shouldn't take the storm into yourself. What you need to do in those circumstances is go into yourself and find peace and then breathe it out on the world. That became my directive, to go into myself and find peace and breathe it out on the world. Now, the irony is that this is the second week of school, and I'm here doing this talk. First of all, I don't know how I agreed to do this talk right now. I mean, Paula is very persuasive, and she's my friend. But what I found since school started 2 weeks ago is that now I'm having to find peace all over again. So I'm not standing in front of you as any expert with this. I'm just talking a little about what my journey is. One of the things I did was I took the summer off. That was the first thing. I made time to read in a very deliberate and intentional way because I was reading essentially nothing besides the summary of the New Yorker that came every day in my voluminous email. And one of the things I read is a book called The Overstory by Richard Powers. That had a profound effect on me. The Overstory is a book about trees. And it talks about trees with some human stories kind of woven into that. But the main idea is really that the trees were here before us. The trees will be here after us. And in the meantime, we live our lives, which have lots of drama and sometimes involve trying to save trees. And that's an interesting endeavor. But actually, the trees have their own ways of saving themselves. They communicate with one another. They heal one another by sending medicinals back and forth. The roots are connected underground in this vast network. If we chop trees down and then go away for a while, eventually the trees will resurrect themselves and begin growing again. What that reminded me of is something that I've always known, which is that there's a much larger story than my story, than our story, than the United States at this critical juncture in history. There's the story of a universe and a planet that will outlast us, And whatever shape we leave it in will certainly have some effect on us and our descendants, but there's a vast process that's unfolding, and we are not at the center of that process. That was really very helpful for me to be reminded of, to be reminded that the Earth's life is measured in eons. It's not measured in terms of a human lifetime. What I'm struggling with right here, right now, is very important to me, and it may or may not be important to you, but basically, in terms of the life of the universe, it's just a tiny speck. In relation to eons, it's almost nothing. So I've been reading a lot this summer and thinking a lot this summer. I signed up for Audible, and what a pleasure to listen to books being read to me. I just finished The Song of Solomon, which I had read years ago, but after Toni Morrison's death, I thought that I would revisit something, and Toni Morrison herself was reading the Audible version of The Song of Solomon. So I'm bringing wonderful things into my car that really are not the PBS update on what happened today with the storm, which incidentally missed us, you know. And I think that part of the issue with our modern world is that we're aware of everything that's happening everywhere. It's hard to remember that we're okay and that the sun is shining. Now, I don't want to say anything about the people who are not okay, because of course that's very sad and we need to help. But it really should not affect our own sense of whether life is right. You know, there's something right about it because this is how life is. I've become much more of a realist. I've always been a striver, and I've always been looking ahead at something I can see ahead, but I'm trying to be more cognizant right now of what is. The things that I've worried about the most in my life are often things that never happen. So in the midst of hurricane season here, I would urge you to get your water or whatever it is you feel you need to do, but just focus on your life and be aware that there's a storm out there in the Gulf, but I don't really get alarmed at all until it's really in Northeast Florida and the cone is coming for me. It's not that someone has taken a Sharpie and extended the cone. It's really that the National Weather Service tells me that I'm in danger. I've worn my principles on my arm for a long time, because it just helps me remember what's important to me. I changed one of my principles as part of this effort at healing. I had been wearing a bracelet that said, "Nevertheless, she persisted." I took that bracelet off and I substituted another. Now I'm wearing a bracelet that says, "I hope you dance." And I'm trying to dance. What Joseph Campbell, as you know, many of you, my hero, says is that a vital person vitalizes everything. And so I think that the priority for all of us is to keep ourselves alive and vital. Because if we are not alive and vital, we have very little to add to the mix except more grumpy comments, you know? Basically, I'm a wealth of grumpy comments. I mean, if you want to see grumpy, come to a faculty meeting at the university, say, or whatever. I mean, I have lots of ideas about how everything should go, but right now I'm trying to dance. So I've changed one of my principles. I'm letting go of the Protestant idea that everything is my responsibility. I can look around the world and I can see all these problems and there are things that I want to be involved with or help, but in the back of my mind always is guilt because I'm not doing the other things. That caused me really a lot of stress because I was well trained in my religious tradition that I grew up in to be stressed by those things and to somehow feel that I had to put in the long hours, I had to be out there on the street or whatever. And I'm much more focused on really looking at what Kierkegaard called the world of my care and concern. And basically, what Kierkegaard said is to say that the self is care, and there's kind of a modern philosophical movement that says that the self is care. To say that the self is care means that we understand and care about ourselves in the world in terms of being connected with what we can and what we cannot do. And so basically, I've always had kind of a world of my care and concern, but it's been very broad. And part of what I did to try to heal myself was to narrow that world and really take a look at what I valued, what I cared about, and what I could realistically do. Now, it doesn't mean that I've abandoned everything that I have been working for. In fact, I'm going to talk to Dolly Berthelot right after this meeting about something that I think Dolly Berthelot should do. But, you know, and I'm going to be doing it too, but fair warning, Dolly, you should really get out of here if you don't want to hear about it. But I was taking care of the concerns of other people very much at my own expense, losing myself in the burdens of the world. And so I narrowed the scope of my activity, and right now I'm evaluating how to get back into things that I care about, but I'm doing it very deliberately, very carefully, and just looking at where I feel I can have the best impact. What Kierkegaard and Heidegger talk about is care as worry and anxiety versus care as solicitude. And I had become very wrapped up in the care that has to do with worry and anxiety rather than solicitude. And so I would encourage you to look at the world of your care and concern. I went to Quebec at the end of the summer and ended up staying in a monastery that was not part of my design. I had gone on a Rhodes Scholar trip, and that was simply where they had made the arrangements. I was having trouble walking. I was having trouble with my knees and my hips and a whole variety of things, and then I fell in the shower. And so I'm like, okay, how am I going to walk from the Plains of Abraham into Quebec? I remembered seeing something downstairs about massage, and I went down and found that I was in this place of healing. It was the oldest hospital in North America, 400 years old, the oldest hospital north of Mexico, and they had a healing program for other people who had come there. So I had a couple of massages, had a private yoga session, I had a neurobed healing session, and it really made a huge difference to me, because this massage therapist was able to get me up and walking around again. In part of my walking around again, I went to an Ursuline museum and saw all of these women whose families had given them away to come into the convent. And I saw them all dressed up as the Bride of Christ, and then a few minutes later dressed in a nun's habit, and going through doors that clanged behind them, and they were cloistered. Bingo. What really impressed me was what these women did with their lives. Even though this was not something that most of them had chosen, they devoted themselves to educating women. They got PhDs, they set up schools, they did a whole variety of things. I was almost in tears as I looked at what they had done with the kind of raw deal that life had given them in a way, although not entirely. I mean, some people really had chosen it. I don't mean to say anything about being a nun. But I also remembered that when I was at Bryn Mawr in the 70s, there were nuns coming out of the convents, And many of them stayed with us, stayed in the house where I was staying. It was really interesting to see what they made of their lives after that, after they came out of the convent too. Fortunately, I was stopping at Bryn Mawr on the way back from Quebec. What I did was I was able to reconnect with my mentors and with another group of mostly women who had devoted their lives to educating women too, and were now old and retired and so forth. And I spent a couple of days there, and it was just very inspiring to me, and it helped me remember what I valued and why I was here, in a sense. And so I would say reconnect with mentors too, because that's a very powerful thing. I reinstituted my meditative and yoga practices as a way of reconnecting not only with my own soul, but really with the world's soul. I think that part of both of those practices is the sense of connection with life beyond yourself and the loosening of boundaries that makes you less concerned with your own ego and your ego concerns. And so that's been enormously helpful, except that I haven't been to yoga since actually school started. So it's an ongoing process. You can't ever feel that you've arrived. I became very deliberate about spending time outside, and especially about going to the beach, because the water heals me. Most days, at the end of the day, I go out and sit on my back porch and commune with a majestic tree that is dying, but it's good for me to think about dying too, because I'm not going to be here forever in the form that I'm in. And that has helped me go deeper into poetry and the insights about the world that come from poetry. I come from a family with macular degeneration, and so I've always expected to go blind. And what I've done since I was a very small girl is memorize poems against the day that I went blind. As I've sat and looked at this tree, I remember my tree poems, I recite them to myself, I remember other poems, and that has also led me into a world that's very different from the world in which I seem to live much more of the time. I've continued my round of visiting doctors because I was having a number of physical problems. What I have to say is I'm not going to do that for much longer. I'm having some surgery on an eye on Thursday. The other eye has to be operated on too. But that may be it. Because what I found with trying to interact with the medical world is that you can spend your day trying to get a doctor's appointment too. Gerotranscendence is this idea as you age of kind of transcending one's identification with one's body. I really am having a lot of trouble with these doctors now, and I'm going to be transitioning out of that as soon as I have this eye surgery. So I would say to you, don't spend your life taking care of the physical problems unless it's something that can really be fixed and fixed pretty easily. I began to exercise more deliberately. I got this watch, and basically I'm going to hit end workout right now because that's not what I'm doing. But at the end of the day, or sort of it is, but basically it tells me how much I've moved today. That has been very important in trying to recover. I made an opera mixtape because I realized that voice and music are transformative too, and that in order to listen to opera, there weren't many naturally occurring opportunities. And so if I wanted to do that, I needed to do that. And sometimes I just sit and listen to it and breathe. Now, the interesting thing about our world is that at this point, somehow, this is on my phone, and somehow it's gotten onto shuffle. At this point now, sometimes it just kicks into this mode where it plays a couple of arias, and then it plays Bruce Springsteen, and then it plays Leonard Cohen, and that's very disconcerting. But the opera mixtape has been wonderful. I'm about to resign from a lot of committees that have, that bring a great deal of conflict into my life. And I'm evaluating generally whether things feed me or whether things drain me. And I'm trying to focus on the eternities rather than the news, because the news I find that I've heard before. There's very little that's actually new to me. And I'm trying to spend time in contemplation about what we do with all of these different groups who have real problems that are competing for our attention, but to whom we can't devote concentrated care all the time. For a long time with Race and Reconciliation, people wanted to do programs on transgender issues, on immigration, on a variety of other issues, but I kind of kept it focused on race because I don't think that you can make anything much happen if your focus is all over the place. I was watching a tape of a meeting with the mayor, supposed to be with the mayor, but he didn't come. And the person who was leading the meeting, which was about police brutality, started out by saying, well, now let's all first introduce ourselves and talk about our pronouns. And I'm like, oh, goodness. I mean, this is a student of mine. I'm like, don't bring pronouns into this meeting with the city officials, because it's just not relevant to what you're trying to accomplish, and it's going to detract from your effort. And so this person said her pronouns, and a couple of other people did. But when it got to the 58-year-old man from the city who was there, he's like, okay, I'm just going to have to tell you that I don't know what you're talking about with this pronoun thing. And really, it very much detracted from the main effort to solve a problem. And so I guess I see a necessity for approaching a lot of these marginalized issues individually, but what our society encourages is that we take the whole thing on and that we try to solve it all at this meeting today. And so I'm trying to figure out what to do about this. I also read a book called Beyond Liberalism that raised the issue with all the competing groups that we try to work with and raised issues of where is the community beyond that. I'm just contemplating where the community beyond that is, because I think if you don't know how to do something or if you don't know what you should do, then maybe you should take a break. So what I'd like to close with today for the closing words is a poem from Antonio Machado, who's one of my favorite Spanish poets. The wind one brilliant day called to my soul with an odor of jasmine. In return for the odor of my jasmine, I'd like all the odor of your roses. I have no roses. All the flowers in my garden are dead. Well then, I'll take the withered petals and the yellow leaves and the waters of the fountain. The wind left, and I wept, and I said to myself, what have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you? And so I'll leave you with that question. What have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you? Is it still a garden? Can you make it a garden again?